Thanks very much for listening on Friday, June 13th, 2014. The Federal News Countdown every Friday in the 3 o'clock hour features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, my experts are John Salamone from FMP. John, how are you? It's great to see you, my friend. Thank you for coming on the program, as always. And Ron Sanders of Booz Allen. It's great to have you back, my friend.
Good to be here, Francis.
It is the all human resources edition of the Federal News Countdown. It just happened that way. I didn't schedule you guys together on purpose. It wasn't like a theme show or anything I was going for. But it's great to have both of you here.
We'll be singing in unison.
I think that would be fantastic. I think I can't remember if we've ever had singing on the Federal News Countdown before. So that would be a first.
And a last.
Yeah, well, there goes your listenership.
Especially if I started singing. The three most important federal news stories of the week, and we start where we always do, of course, with
number three.
Ron, your choice at number three is from Stephanie Wasco on federalnewsradio.com. The headline is, report says Chico's left out of agency decisions. And this is work from the Government Accountability Office that Robert Goldenkopf from GAO was on the program talking about with me earlier in the week. But this seems to me to be the same kind of issues in the chief human capital officers community that we've had in the chief information officers community for a long time about them not being at the table when major decisions are made that regard their portfolios. Am I on track there, do you think?
Yes, but maybe for different reasons.
Okay.
I think that in those cases where a chief human capital officer doesn't get a seat at the table, it's likely because they've sort of made their own bed. I think those Chicos that have shown collaborative skills with their senior leadership team, have been creative, they're going to have that doesn't mean they just say yes. There are instances where they're going to have to demonstrate courage. But I think it's the creativity to be able to, first, know the rules. Second, know the gaps and seams and ambiguities in the rules, and there are plenty. And then three, being willing to help senior leadership navigate through those rules. My own experience, Francis, is that an agency head comes in and says, I want to go here. And they want to go the most direct route possible.
Mm-hmm.
And there are sometimes landmines in that most direct route. But if I can show them, you take a little bit of a swing here and a deviation there, and I can get you to the same place, they do what you're doing right now, and that's nod. Charles Rosati, a former IRS commissioner, once told me that he thought the Internal Revenue Service, the Internal Revenue Code, was complex. But after he got the job as commissioner, he found that it paled in comparison to Title V.
Uh-huh.
But he was more than willing to help to accept a detour along the way as long as I got him where he wanted to be. And I think Chicos that have learned that get a seat at the table, and they're invaluable. But old school Chicos who are there just to say no, I think the GAO report is spot on.
GAO recommends Chicos strengthen coordination to address a fragmented human capital community, use enterprise services to address shared challenges, create more agile talent management processes to address inflexibilities in the current system. Translate that into human speak rather than GAO and Chico speak.
Well, I think this is at least in part consistent with an overarching theme you've seen from GAO and from Robert, that interagency collaboration and cooperation and coordination, those are all keys to more effective government. And I think what they're saying in the human capital community is that the more of that, the better, so that those human capital officers that may not know how to navigate the seams and gaps can talk about that with their peers. They may be a support group when the Chico needs to say no and stick by it, but they may also be a support group when the Chico needs help in navigating for his or her senior leadership, and they can help that person find the way.
Ron Sanders' third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is, report says Chico's left out of agency decisions. John Salamone, you also have good taste at number three. You have a federalnewsradio.com story from my colleague Shefali Kapadia. The headline is, are agencies meeting cross-agency goals? OMB reviews make it hard to tell. And another GAO examination of what's going on at agencies, this in regarding the GIPRA Modernization Act, and Chris Mim, who wrote this one's going to be on the program on Monday talking about this work. But this is, I guess I'll use the word unfortunate review of how agencies are actually doing and how OMB is doing at overseeing agencies' executions of these cross-agency performance goals.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, what jumped out at me is that it's consistent in what GAO is finding, that there is a lack of relevant information, including timelines for particular goals, and the status of ongoing efforts. And, you know, kind of dovetailing with Ron's points that he was making with the chief human capital officers, and it's very difficult to establish measures for cross-agency priority goals because you're looking at a number of agencies that have to weigh in. But I think, you know, if I'm sitting in the administration, and I know that there's 2 years left, two or three years left in the administration, we're thinking about legacy. Mm-hmm. And if you cannot demonstrate the progress that you're making in these very important selective goals that you've achieve or the goals that you've set for the administration, then I'm not sure what the legacy of the administration is going to be. So it'll be interesting for me personally to see Sean Donovan, you know, was nominated for the OMB director, had his nomination hearing this week, was on Capitol Hill really pronouncing the importance of GPRA and GPRA modernization. I really do think in the next 2 years you're going to see a strong push from OMB to put these goals, these measures in place, a way to capture them, a way to identify them, and a way to report them that makes sense. But it has to be done in a very concerted effort, in a very coordinated fashion, and a concerted effort, not only just these, you know, kind of long-term targets, but what are the quarterly targets that agencies are trying to hit. And it's not an easy thing for agencies to do. They've struggled with it for a long time. They're continuing to struggle with it now. But I think, you know, the administration's legacy, they're going to have to put some procedures in place to capture that information.
Three passages from Shefali's story jumped out at me, John. One of them, GAO found many of the reviews lacked relevant information, such as timeframes for particular goals and status of ongoing efforts. That seems like pretty basic stuff. Another one that jumped out at me, of the 14 cap goal reviews GAO studied, six of the reviews didn't have the quantitative data necessary to measure progress. Another, it sounds like a big piece to me. And the third one that I noted was only three cap goals, cybersecurity, energy efficiency, and strategic sourcing, included quarterly targets that, according to the report, allowed for an assessment of interim progress. Essentially, again, only three had the information that was necessary, the quarterly targets that were necessary to figure out if you were still on target.
Yes.
That sounds like the very basic information that's required isn't being kept by these agencies.
It's not being kept. It's not being collected. The other thing that wasn't in the article that jumps out at me, if you look at the cross-agency priority goals from the previous set to this set, there's no consistency. I shouldn't say there's no consistency. There's some consistency, but the human capital goal of closing mission-critical gaps in mission-critical occupations fell off the list. I'm not really sure if they had any data to suggest why it fell off the list, or should it have fallen off the list. Mm-hmm. If it's not a priority, then fine. But I think if there's no consistency, are they making progress? Can they demonstrate that progress? And I don't think it's being demonstrated.
John Salamone's third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is, "Are Agencies Meeting Cross-Agency Goals? OMB Reviews Make It Hard to Tell." And you can read more about that and all the stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. And again, shameless plug, Chris Mim from GAO, who did that report, is on In-Depth with Francis Rose Monday afternoon, 5:05 on Federal News Radio. When we come back on the Federal News Countdown, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by John Salamone and Ron Sanders. We'll be right back. We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Ron Sanders and John Salamone. And John, your second most important federal news story of the week is from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is, U.S. Struggles to Draw Young, Savvy Staff. And as I read this, I thought this was very insightful, the Wall Street Journal, to look at this. I'm glad they did. Mm-hmm. But they covered a lot of issues here that we've talked about on this program, that you and I have discussed and that Ron and I have discussed and we've kind of all worked on together. But this continues to be, this calls attention to the fact that the federal government continues to struggle with matching the private sector, at least in the way it presents itself, and it presents opportunity to potential new employees.
Yeah, and this article jumped out at me as critically important right now. And really, when I look at this, it talks about things, like you said, we've been discussing for a long time. Max Dyer in the article says the hiring process is broken, and OPM says we're making progress against it. And, you know, you look at the GAO report from 1979, it would say the same thing about the hiring process then that it does today. I mean, I think it's really a double-edged sword. Not only are we having a recruitment problem, I think we also have a retention problem of younger professionals coming into the workforce. Quite candidly, Partnership for Public Service, and I think Ron and his organization at Booz did a study with the partnership where they were saying 24% of newly hired employees were leaving their jobs within 2 years. I went back, that study was a little dated, 2010. So I went back to FedScope and looked at the data for 5, 7, and 9 levels, specifically those that are college or master's degree candidates.
Mm-hmm.
FY 2011, the government hired 61,000 roughly people at that level. The next fiscal year, 11,000 employees with less than 1 year of experience at the 5, 7, and 9 level left government service. The next year, another 8,400 people left. So you're looking at 61,000 people hired in FY11. Within 2 years, 20,000 of them have left the government.
A third of them are gone in two years.
Gone.
What do we learn from that, Ron?
Well, I think that says that even those that are willing to run the gauntlet of the hiring process, and what a relief it is, I've made it in. And agencies that don't have good onboarding programs, that don't give their new troops challenging assignments, rotations, training, etc., all of those may be in the recruitment brochure, but the reality in a federal agency these days is that often doesn't happen. And I think talented folks vote with their feet. Francis, I'm more concerned about the gauntlet. We've all three talked about the requirement that an applicant who applies for a job in one agency and who may make the best qualified list but isn't selected has to reapply for the exact same job in 1 or 2 or 10 other agencies, where that agency that says, I've got 5 highly qualified candidates, I'm only hiring 1, the other 4 I'm going to share with people who have similar vacancies so that that applicant doesn't have to shotgun the world, pepper the world with applications, because they'll get frustrated and they'll just not do it.
Yeah, they won't bother. A couple of things in this piece that I thought were interesting and that I've heard also anecdotally. This piece quotes Jeremy Warren, spent 7 years in government starting at the age of 29, the former chief technology officer at the Justice Department. He came in 29, CTO at a cabinet-level federal agency, left government work in 2011, he says, because he wanted to, quote, be driving a speedboat rather than pulling an oar on an ocean liner. Mm-hmm. Now, you could look at that a couple of different ways. You could look at that as the big fish, small pond concept, because he's now 40 and vice president of innovation at home automation company Vivint Incorporated. I didn't look up any information about Vivint, so I don't know if they're a big or small company or anything about that. Certainly, they're not as big as the Justice Department of the United States of America, at least in import, if not size. But that's a pretty telling comment, John, about how somebody that's right in the pocket of the kind of person that I think we want at mid to high levels of the federal government thought about his service.
Yeah, and the question that I would have for him is, would he consider coming back?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, why? And I think agencies have to have a good handle on why people are leaving their leaving jobs for the private sector. Is it because, like Ron said, they're not getting challenging assignments, they're not engaged, they don't see career paths, they don't understand that at a GS-7 where they could be a GS-15 or 14 in 5 or 7 years if they have the right opportunities, if they're rotating and whatnot. But really, I think we have to look at the federal workforce a little bit differently. No one's going to come in, or not no one, but the days of a 30-year career in one agency are over. I've been working for 20-plus years. I've had 5 or 6 jobs. I will probably go back to federal service at some point, but we have to have that mindset and that mentality. If you have somebody that's good and somebody that's talented and they leave for the private sector, can you get them back? Can you inspire them to come back and serve in another capacity?
Richard Boley, a retired director at the State Department, spent 20 years in diplomatic roles, recalled hearing about a star candidate from Google who applied in 2009 for a job running an online program connecting U.S. students with government workers abroad. The candidate never made it on the list of acceptable potential hires because a lower-level employee screened the person out. State Department spokeswoman responds, the department adheres to government-wide hiring regulations as established by the Office of Personnel Management, and I'm sure they do. Nothing that anybody said. And Mr. Boley says, the process itself is this little black box that is not efficient and a little slow and may not always surface the best candidates. Now, he's not saying anything that we haven't talked about in our community for, what, 20 years, 10 years longer? But... And also, the comment from the State Department spokeswoman is also accurate. I mean, I would imagine that the State Department does a pretty good job of adhering to the requirements that they have to follow. So that means, to me, the requirements need some help, rather than if that's the kind of person that we're missing out on. Am I off base, Ron?
Well, there may be another cause, depending on whether that clerk that screened that applicant out had any awareness of the context of the requirements. You know, they may be all here are the requirements of the job. They can read them, but do they really understand them? And I think that's an argument for having the hiring official intimately involved, not just at the terminal step, here are the five highly qualified, but all along, and maybe not screening individual resumes, but being available to work with that personnel clerk who may be screening out. I'll give you an example of a job that we filled at OPM without naming names. We asked for resumes for an SES job. The individual sent in a resume. He had been the director of HR for a multinational for the subcontinent of India. He had like 25,000 people reporting to him. But because he didn't write the ECQs up in narrative form, the staffing specialist disqualified him. When all you had to do is look at the resume and see, this guy has led people, he's led change. So I think there's another – so both of those statements may be true, and it's that middle person who may be screening it out just because they don't understand what's going on.
John Salamone's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is U.S. Struggles to Draw Young, Savvy Staff, and I commend that to anybody that cares about these issues. It's linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, like all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown. Ron Sanders, your choice at number two is from Defense One. The headline is One Chart That Shows the Many Ways Congress Wants to Fix the VA. Now, I'm always skeptical whenever somebody in Congress says, I have a piece of legislation that's going to fix fill in the blank, because it doesn't ever seem to work out that way. We seem to come back to issues on an ongoing basis. This list, though, I see themes in a lot of these pieces of legislation. And, I mean, in this day and age, for members of both parties and members of both chambers to get somewhat in line on any particular issue says change is coming, and not all of these things are necessarily good for the workforce at VA. And by the nature of that, it seems to me, the federal government workforce as a whole.
I agree with that, and we can explore that further. I do want to say, look, this isn't about piling on VA. Francis, the reason I included this story is because this is like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. And even when you look at all of the pieces of those pieces of legislation, you get an incomplete picture. VA is an organization in distress. No one can deny that. I worry about treating symptoms and not root causes. Culture, technology, process. We need to get behind the headlines and look at those root causes. Otherwise, it's not going to get fixed. So a couple of examples from my previous lives that I would offer up as lessons learned. IRS in 1998, the headlines looked very similar. The difference is that the president appointed a commission. Commission worked pretty quickly. But it was a bipartisan commission that said, here's a blueprint for restructuring and reforming the IRS. Congress held its hearings, but with minor changes, the commission recommendations, that those bipartisan recommendations, sailed through. And they included a comprehensive toolkit to make the changes real. There were personnel flexibilities in there. There were procurement flexibilities. There was something called the IRS Oversight Board, which, again, is potentially a lesson learned for what's going on with the with VA. Congressional oversight serves one purpose, but I don't think any legislator would suggest that he or she operates like a board of directors for a big healthcare provider. It would be nice if VA, for example, had, much like IRS, a group of experts who know about healthcare, who can serve as a sounding board, who can help translate what's going on there to folks in the Hill and OMB. Again, kind of a board of directors. So I think if we had deja vu all over again with the intelligence community. There was a bipartisan commission, one appointed by the president. Actually, there were two, one appointed by the president, one by the Congress. They both reached similar conclusions. When we walked in the door in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, I was employee number 9, we had a blueprint that everyone had agreed to. Now, not all the blanks were filled in, fortunately. We had some maneuvering room, but we had a blueprint. We also had that same kind of board of directors, the president's, now it's now called the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, that served the same purpose. It sounds bureaucratic to stick another layer of oversight between an agency and the Congress, but this is sort of an operational oversight, again, like a board of directors. And there, too, that blueprint provided flexibilities that that helped us actually implement the reform, and they were comprehensive, so we could deal with culture and technology and process, get at root causes. And I think those are some lessons that we ought to be looking to as we approach VA, because, again, there are lots of pieces to the puzzle here, but I'm not sure when you put them together the whole picture is there.
I want to ask you, John, about some of the political dynamics at play here, because you worked for a Republican senator who probably has the best reputation of any Republican in the last 30 years on federal employee issues. That was Senator George Voinovich, retired now, senator from Ohio. When you look at this list and you see things like this, Republican Senator from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, suggesting legislation that would allow veterans to sue VA employees at the employee's expense. Here's one that's being proposed by a Democrat, Dina Titus from Nevada in the House, would cut bonuses at the VA by 14% for 5 years. Now, I don't know much about her record on federal employee issues or whether she has paid much attention to them before now or not. But I believe it's fair to say, typically, Democrats are viewed as the party that is more supportive of federal employees, mm-hmm. and Republicans are viewed as the party that are less supportive of federal employees. When you see this mix of what's going on here and who's proposing what, do you agree or disagree that the spectrum is shifting in the direction that is not favorable at all to federal employees as a whole? Because at some point, what happened at the IRS in the 90s and what happened in the Intel community and is happening now at the VA is bound to happen in another agency. And it will be very easy for these members or other members to come back and say, well, we did this at the VA. Why don't we do the same thing here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is troubling to see some of these provisions. I think what you want to do and what Senator Voinovich was so good at was trying to find practical solutions. You're always going to have, one side or the other, and they're going to be extremes. What realistically is going to pass? And I think if you look at the Senate bill, there are some protections in place. I think the bill gives the Secretary of the Department the authority to fire or demote an SESer. I think, demoting is probably something that will be more likely, but I think it will take tremendous courage to fire somebody. And I think in this instance where you have a cover up of, waiting times and it was systemic, that there should be some firings at the VA, and that if it is so egregious that literally veterans that have served our nation are not getting the care that they need, that the people working in the department that are part of the problem don't deserve to serve our nation.
There's another issue at play here too, Ron, and I haven't seen much connection of this. There was a little bit of coverage when this first broke that part of the reason that these waiting lists, that this second set of books were established essentially, were in order for employees to meet performance goals. Now, part of that has to do with bonuses. Part of it just has to do with trying to demonstrate up the chain that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. And I wonder if we'll see, as we probably should out of this, an examination of how we go about setting performance goals, not associated with the bonuses necessarily, but just are we measuring the right things and are we realistically providing the folks that we expect to execute the resources they need to be able to meet these goals, or are we giving them unreasonable expectations and therefore setting them up to fail and make terrible mistakes? I'm not discounting the mistakes that people made at VA. They were egregious and awful. But are we putting people into situations where their choices are really, really bad?
Francis, I think that's spot on. Again, my point in choosing this story is that there are systemic causes for this behavior. There are behaviors that cross the line. It should be dealt with. But listen to what we're saying. Should we have performance goals? Should they be quantitative? Should there be quality goals? The answer is absolutely yes, but anything in its extreme could have its pathologies. So in our earlier segment, we talked about the cross-agency priorities and the lack of quantitative measures and metrics there. So I worry that we abandon that. We throw the baby out with the bathwater here. So, again, I'm not going to comment on the legislation, the pieces of legislation that are pending. I do think, though, that there are pieces of the puzzle that have not yet been examined. They're the systemic ones, and I think they need to be examined, and I think any manager and executive, frankly, any employee manager and executive in VA will tell you, if you give us the right tools and resources, none of this will happen. All right, so let's get at those root causes. Let's find out what tools and resources are necessary to serve our veterans, mm-hmm. and make sure that VA has them. That to me is looking forward.
John, Ron, I think, deserves credit for not, you know, puffing himself up any more than he did, but he did. He's much more powerful than we knew. He managed to get his name on the Senate bill.
Look at that,
the McCain-Sanders bill. That's very well done.
That's Bernard, no relation.
Oh, that's right, the chairman of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. I thought it was you. Okay. Your choice, by the way, Ron, for the second most important federal news story of the week is from Defense One, one chart that shows the many ways Congress wants to fix the VA. You can find that chart and that story and all the stories on today's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week is selected by John Salamone and Ron Sanders on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose. This is In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. You're listening to the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by John Salamone and Ron Sanders. And we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Ron Sanders, is Joe Davidson's column on in the Washington Post. The headline is, VA story has a lesson for unions. Don't sleep on civil service reform. And Joe's on target here, Ron. I'm struck by the lack of involvement that I see from any federal employee unions, really. And I don't know why that is. Do you have a sense of why? I mean, Joe specifically mentions AFGE. The American Federation of Government Employees, in this piece, but it's not just them. I mean, I haven't really heard much from any of the unions about this, and I wonder why that is. Do you have a sense of why?
Well, generally, Francis, you know that Booz Allen and the Partnership for Public Service came out with a civil service reform blueprint a couple of months ago, and we vetted it beforehand with a number of stakeholder groups. And that was some of the reaction was just that devil you know versus the devil you don't. If you open up the civil service system for reform, you may get something worse than we have now. So maintain the status quo no matter how problematic it may be. And I think we've seen this now for two decades. If we don't have comprehensive reform, we will see the civil service system continue to be balkanized, agency by agency. I'll confess, Francis, that I've driven that balkanization from a number of agencies because I couldn't get the flexibilities I needed out of OPM, for example. So we made our separate peace with Congress. I'm certainly not alone in that regard. So you, instead of a government-wide and enterprise-wide civil service system, that was the original design way back when, It's now gerrymandered. This is another example of gerrymandering. Merits notwithstanding, the fact is an agency-by-agency approach to trying to reform the system, you can put that in quotes if you like, is going to continue to exacerbate the problem. So I think we need to take a deep breath, all of us, particularly all of the stakeholders who have something to say about the civil service system, and start thinking about comprehensive reform, picking the best of those flexibilities that agencies have been able to achieve over the years, so that all of this is treated comprehensively in an integrated way, other than piecemeal.
The piecemeal way, though, John, seems to be the way Congress wants to do it right now. They want to fix the crisis du jour, which is the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VHA, and to step back and do as Ron is suggesting and say, wait a minute, what's the root cause of the problem here and how can we address that problem all across government? Nobody seems to care about that right now.
Yeah, and the public outrage, I think, is driving the quickness in the in which Congress is reacting and acting, I should say. I mean, I'll talk a little bit about this in my number one story as well. But I think that the House and Senate, my prediction is that they will have a reform package on the president's desk before July 4th. And I don't want to be cynical or anything, but what I can envision is that there are members of Congress saying we need to get this done because the July 4th recess is coming up and I'm going to be at a 4th of July parade and there are going to be a lot of veterans and I need to say that I did the right thing and we fixed the Department of Veterans Affairs.
That's not cynical. That's real.
Yeah.
That's reality. That's exactly what these people are up against.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No. So I think, you know, the challenge becomes, as Ron said, we at some point need to have an enterprise-wide reform. We have a fractured civil service system that has layers upon layers put on it, flexibilities at some agencies that they have recruitment advantages over others, flexibilities within certain occupations. Law enforcement officers at one agency may get additional benefits that they might not get at another agency. So there are problems with the system as a whole. Right now, the challenge that I see is that there is not an appetite in the authorizing committees, the House Government Reform and the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, to take this issue on right now. I don't think it's, you know, something that it's not sexy, quote unquote, you know, at this point.
Joe gets at a point in this piece, Ron, that we talked about a little bit in the last part of the countdown, and that I think is the critical element here. The VA is the target this time, but will places such as the Internal Revenue Service and the General Services Administration, which have had their own scandals in recent years, be next? If Congress slashes civil service protections for senior executives who aren't unionized, what's to stop legislators from doing the same to other federal employees? There is a contingent in Congress, and unfortunately, it looks, as Joe makes, like it's from both parties, at least regarding the VA situation, where people are willing to say those people shouldn't have those rights that, as you talked about earlier, these other folks over here have, and it's making that balkanization worse.
So I think that erosion of the status quo, and you know that's a negative trajectory. That's far more likely than incremental improvements to the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't take it on comprehensively, the most likely scenario is that the next scandal that comes along, you're going to see incremental retrenchment, not incremental improvement, but retrenchment. So if you stand pat, it's just going to get worse. All you got to look at are the pay freezes. Those aren't going to get better until you fix the pay system. You may get some increase out of the administration in the Congress, 1%. I'm not sure anybody would argue that 1% does much good other than, you know, puts some money in folks' pockets and that helps. But in terms of the government being able to compete in a larger labor market, we still have the overpay underpay phenomenon that you're always going to get with the pay system. So again, I think standing pat means it's just going to get worse drip by drip by drip. And we need some courage from all quadrants to look at this in a comprehensive way and move it forward. The administration has proposed a Blue Ribbon Commission. They've done this a couple of times. That sounds really bureaucratic, but it's also a way of getting some bipartisan agreement over a strategic issue. And maybe it's time to revisit that. I haven't been a fan of that commission, but, you know, something's got to break. Somebody's got to – somebody's got to step back and say, where are we going to be in 5 or 10 years? We better start now.
Ron Sanders' most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is VA story has a lesson for unions. Don't sleep on civil service reform. You can read that and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the Federal News Countdown wraps up with John Salamone's choice for the most important federal news story of the week. That's next on In-Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories as selected this week by Ron Sanders and John Salamone. And John, your choice at number one this week is from federalnewsradio.com. Lawmakers push to approve unified veterans bill. And we continue in the kind of the thread that we were on with Ron's bill and Ron's choice for number one. He actually was on this, the McCain-Sanders bill.
Yeah, most definitely. And I took a look at the legislation that the Senate passed and really, you know, setting aside the politics and some of the issues, really wanted to see what was in the bill from a management standpoint, and, you know, obviously carrying on the conversation that we've been having. But it jumped out at me. There were four or five provisions from a management standpoint that I think are particularly interesting and worth noting. I mean, first and foremost, the legislation, the Senate legislation, requires an annual report detailing the top five healthcare occupations within the VA that have the largest staffing shortage. So we're trying to get to the staffing shortage. Where are the problems within the VA? Allows the secretary to appoint highly qualified healthcare experts to fill those occupations. So we're talking about some hiring flexibilities to bring individuals in. Next, there's really a comprehensive workforce planning criteria in there that the department has to assess the staffing at each medical facility within the department to make sure that they've got the appropriate medical, non-medical staffing levels by facility, the appropriate physical plant space, a list of current wait times and workloads at each clinic. So you're really getting into workload and the workforce issues. And then the Senate bill also allowed the secretary to use unobligated funds to hire additional healthcare providers at VHA by at the end of FY14 and 15. And then finally, the provisions about demoting, as we had talked about, or removing a member of the SES for performance reasons.
So there are a lot of things in there that, as you listen to them, Ron, you say, well, that makes sense. That will benefit vets. One of the things that strikes me, and I read about it this week, and I think we talked about it before we went on the air. I don't remember if it was on the air or off the air. But there are facilities in the VA health system that are underutilized. And I don't see anybody taking into account the fact that maybe in the VA health system, we need something like a BRAC where we look at how these installations are being used and decide whether they need to continue to be as big as they are or whether those resources are better deployed, more needed someplace else.
So, again, I think that's yet another argument for stepping back and taking a much more comprehensive approach, whether that's done legislatively or administratively. Francis, you're talking about the very kinds of flexibilities that others have been given in order to go beyond the symptoms and get at root causes. You know, like every agency, VA's appropriations are compartmentalized. It may be that they've got excess funds over here that they could, with reprogramming flexibility, put against additional hiring. Again, we're looking at pieces of the puzzle. We ought to look at the whole picture. Yeah, I am gratified that the Senate bill, including my namesake, again, no relation, has some management stuff in it. But, you know, I would push it a little bit, go a little bit further. Are there hiring flexibilities? You know, you got the resources. Mm-hmm. You're now required to identify the staffing gaps. Are there hiring flexibility so that they can actually go out and compete for nurses and docs?
An interesting perception issue when it comes to that very thing, and I don't have the list in front of me. I'm sorry. I should have pulled it out. But I got an email from a guy who is a patient at the Veterans Hospital in Wichita and happens to be a radio host at a radio station in Wichita. And he sent me, he said, I was in the hospital today, and I wrote down these jobs that were open and the pay scale. And they were posted in the hospital. And they were, one of them was, I think, like the director of the radiology department. I mean, it was a pretty high-level job, some of them. And some of them were were lower-level positions. And I went back to him and I said, why are the numbers significant to you? And he said, well, they're a lot of money in Wichita. And I said, are they a lot of money compared to what the average guy walking down the street makes? Or are they a lot of money compared to what, say, the director of radiology at the biggest private hospital in Wichita makes? And he didn't know. And this issue is going to come back to the same issue that we've talked about before. We're almost out of time. But the same issue that we've talked about before, which is how much do people in the federal government make compared to people doing the same thing in the private sector? And that's just a very base
occupation
human resources.
By occupation.
Yeah, that's a very base conversation that some piece of legislation in Congress is not going to do anything about. John, last words.
No, I think like Ron said, there are gaps within the gaps in the pay system. And that's something, again, why we need a comprehensive look at civil service reform.
I'm sorry that we're so tight on time. Thank you both, gentlemen. John Salamone, Ron Sanders.
Thanks,
on the
Francis.
Federal News Countdown. Terrific, as always. You can hear the show and read all the stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Later this afternoon, hour number 2 of In Depth is next.